North Georgia Business Radio presents the best of Business Radio X. Business Radio X serves as the voice of business in cities around the country. And every day, Business Radio X lets you hear from business leaders, executives, managers, and business owners, allowing them to share their stories of success. I'm Mike Salmond, and today on the show, we're going to share some of the conversations heard recently in our Business Radio X studio in Gwinnett County. Today on the show, is it possible to fly from New York City to Paris, France, in only an hour and a half? Well, an Atlanta-based company says it's developing an aircraft that will travel five times the speed of light. The future of hypersonic travel is closer than you may think. Also on today's show, a candid discussion with area doctors about mental illness, what it is, and why a lot of people don't talk about it. And later on, a local tax expert shares some common tax problems and how you can avoid a call from your friends at the IRS. But up first, a conversation from Marketing Matters with Ryan Sowers about how to sell effectively and the right way. This week's guest was Alicia Wehner with the Brand & Britt Insurance Agency.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. So you've grown up doing everything in sales.
Yes.
I mean, so tell me about your growing up from 14 on doing sales.
Yeah, I did. I started work when I was 14 years old.
Awesome.
TZBY yogurt.
Okay, I know what that
and
is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I probably ate a little bit more product than maybe I sold. I don't know.
Okay.
It was a learning experience. I've always been into sales. When I was younger, I used to walk around my house when I was little and ask my parents if they wanted to give me their order. I used to pretend to have clients come by my room. Every single item in my room had an inventory number.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
It was a big ordeal.
That's awesome.
It was pretty funny. My mom owned a jewelry store. I kind of learned from her about how to do things. And so I said, you know, one day I'm going to own my own thing and I'm going to sell things to people. And here I am.
Here you are.
Selling insurance.
What was it about sales that really just kind of resonated with you and got you so excited?
I think the conversation and the promoting of self. I think that people buy from people that they like. They trust people. They like to build the relationships with people. And I think that that's the part of marketing to me that resonates with others. I enjoy talking to people. I love joking around with people.
You know, it's funny you say that. I used to broadcast myself playing basketball against myself. So when I didn't have someone to play with, I would be like Ryan versus Todd, my middle name, right? Ryan for three.
Yes!
Ryan's up 1-0.
Yes!
My parents were like, what is wrong with him? I mean, it's like Todd with the three is 3-2. And, you know, I had this love of sports and broadcasting, whatever. So there you go. You know, you kind of come full circle. But you got to practice it. And it sounds ridiculous, but that's how you get good. And
that's right.
Sales is in your blood or it's not.
And it's right. It's not. It's really not a teachable thing, in my opinion.
Now, where did you go from TCBY yogurt?
After the yogurt thing, I went into shoes. And then I went into a retail space at a local mall. And then I went into banking. And banking is actually where my professional career began. And I started as a part-time teller while I was in school. And then when I got out, they wanted to promote me. And I was like, well, of course.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to promote this? You
know? You're like, I still got ties into 10% off yogurt.
Right.
I mean,
there were so many past coupons that I had from all the different places.
That was probably what got you the job at the end. If they were to weigh in their options,
that's how I won over their love. It was interesting because when I got out at, you know, we want to put you on this travel team. And this was with Main Street Bank. If any of y'all are familiar with it, it used to be a bank, a very popular bank around Atlanta. After that point, I learned so many different job functions. And I was very personable. I think my personality had a lot to do with it. They put me into the training department. And they were forming this training department because they were buying other banks and they wanted to teach everybody their ways. And so I really got to meet, and I was very lucky to be in that department because I got to meet every single one of my coworkers. And I think interacting with so many different people, especially in a vulnerable state, you know, where their life is changing, their bank name is changing, you know, different things from different walks of life. I think it really propelled me to be able to operate well in the sales world.
I remember my father told me this when I was head to college. He was showing me something like at a fast food restaurant. He says, you know, somebody sold that piece and somebody sold that plastic and somebody sold this road pavement to this company.
Sometimes twice.
But we all know, and that's what I said in a previous episode, I said everyone's in sales. And what I mean by that is not in terms of their job function per se. Some people are, but is in terms of a way of If you can find, we've all mutually, you know, we've all done stuff together. It's like, can we find a fit that's a good fit? Because people often ask me, I'd like y'all's insights. They'll say, isn't there another way of sales where, you know, there's the pushy pest, drive people crazy? And they're like, but we found that to be effective, right? I'm like, great. And I'm not saying it can't be. That's not my style. I want someone to do something if they feel good about it and they feel it's a fit for them.
That's exactly right. It's got to be a fit. There's got to be an alignment. Sales may be the industry. The method, though, is customized and aligned to who you are mm-hmm. as a person and what you're trying to do. Right. Would you find that true,
Absolutely.
Alicia?
You know, I want to do business with people that I enjoy doing business with. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I've got to spend an exorbitant amount of time doing different things, mm-hmm. I really want to do it for people that enjoy the amount of effort that I put into it, but then also I don't have to chase them.
You've been working since you were 14.
Yes.
So in this age of where specialization seems to be the thing, how has your breadth of experience helped you in your role today?
I get enjoyment out of helping people. So when I have a client that comes in and they're, you know, let's say they're a restaurant, I'm able to figure out a way to assist them in multiple different ways, not just insurance, but have you thought about this? Have you gone through proper training for your employees and having employees now? Have you thought about the way that this can happen? You know, it's always, insurance is always such a wonderful bouncing area to 5,000 different things. If you have employees, you always have to think about what would happen. We know you're good people. We know you're good owners. We know you have a wonderful place of business. But what if? What if everybody that worked for you wasn't like you? What if everybody that you brought in the door didn't do the right things? What are you going to do then? People always try to tell me, I'm the best driver ever. I'm the best driver ever. My insurance should be lower. Well, that's wonderful. I am so glad you're a great driver. What about the other guy? I mean, I got in like almost six wrecks getting over here.
I know.
Only on Pleasant Hill. So, you know. So I always try to make them think about things from a different perspective, and it's only from my experiences with all of the different clients that I had in banking. I went into commercial lending later. You learn every single thing there is to know about a person, their family, their way of life, their livelihood, because at the end of the day, that's what you're in charge of, and you have to respect that. By learning through all of these different businesses and their successes and their failures, and now into the insurance world, and being able to parlay all of that together, I love it. I love it. That I get no greater joy than to sit down with somebody and say, you know what, I helped them in five different areas, not just, hey, you want to sign this piece of paper and buy some insurance. Right,
right. And you know, my career, of all the things I've sold, if you will, I don't care if it's $5 or I've sold stuff that's $5 million. I get genuine satisfaction and adrenaline from helping. But right. 95% of the time, it's quality people who you spend a lot of time with. Mm-hmm. And that relationship and that trust, and people buy from people. And I think we've lost sight
exactly.
of this customer
yeah,
service
hello.
Element, right?
Right.
We're getting back to, we've gotten so away, and it's nothing. We're doing Facebook Live, and that's awesome. And all these tools are out there. But what we're forgetting is people can sit behind a keyboard and sit behind and put out tweets and whatever. But if you don't have this, mm-hmm. at some point, you don't have to do it every day. You can't create this.
Well, you can't create energy from a device.
That's exactly right.
You just can't. And one of the things I love about you, Alicia, and we just met today and talked briefly before the show, is your energy that you bring to the table.
Thank you.
And, you know, that's one of the things, one of my factors that I look for when I'm talking with potential clients. Can we work together? Are mm-hmm. we a fit? And I clearly heard you say you use two coaching skills, a coach approach to what you're doing. You listen, and then you ask them questions.
Oh, yes.
You know, have you thought about, that's a coach approach to sales, which is a great thing to do.
But you know how few traditional salespeople do that. They walk in, and there's somebody could be saying to Ryan, like, you know, actually very interested. Like, did I tell you about now on our website? And they just talk right over them and don't listen.
It's all about them.
And you know, it's those deep why level questions. So why are you feeling this way? Where's your family headed? What are you trying to do? What is your business trying to do? And I've always coached salespeople, and you can see I'm passionate about this. Mm-hmm. They would go out on a call. I'd coach them up before they'd go. They'd come back. I'd say, so where are we at? And they're like, what'd they say on that? We're not sure. What'd they say on that? I can't remember. What'd they say on that? I forgot to ask. Like, okay, so you went on the call. I didn't, and we know the same thing. Nothing. I mean, why did you even go, right? It's like having a little.
Well, that takes time. That takes time and a willingness to sit with it and allow the process to develop. I'm curious, Alicia, how is it that you learned that, even at age 14? But in all of your, what's one thing that stands out?
I don't know exactly what I learned at age 14. I knew I wanted to work. I knew I wanted to get out and make things and do something for myself. I wasn't asked to go. I begged my parents to take me around because a couple of my friends were working, and I was like, I want to have a job too. I want to be able to buy my own things whenever I want, you know? And they were like, well, all right, well, let's go look. And I found it. But I think you have to have that want.
The drive.
Yes. You know, it's not about necessity. It's about wanting to do for yourself or wanting to do for others.
And that's just part of the conversation about sales on Marketing Matters with Ryan Sowers. To hear the entire interview, visit businessradiox.com, select the Gwinnett Studio, and then click on Marketing Matters. Coming up next, behavioral health or mental illness. Whatever you want to call it, there's a lot of questions about what it is, who has it, and what treatments are available. Two experts weigh in on the topic next, right here on North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X. Welcome back to North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X, where we are sharing some of the on-air interviews from this past week. A mental illness is a disease that causes mild to severe disturbances in thought and/or behavior, and it can make it difficult to cope with life's ordinary demands or routines. There are more than 200 classified forms of mental illnesses out there, but not a whole lot of people understand the disease. On a recent edition of Gwinnett Business Radio, we got some answers from Dr. Joshua Morris and Jared Rowe, behavioral health experts at Eastside Medical Center. Mental illness, what does that mean?
It's really a broad term. It really encompasses anything that affects behavior or affects your mood or affects your ability to perceive reality. So that can be a lot of things from major depressive disorder, what people call depression typically, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, things like that. And then something as simple as anxiety. Even dementia is included in mental illness or a psychiatric condition.
Let's say they suffer from a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress and so forth. How does one know when it crosses the line into a mental illness?
When we look clinically at the different levels of treatment that we offer and the difference in maybe someone who has some social anxiety and sees a counselor or is going through, you know, some relationship issues and sees a counselor, we're really looking at the severity of the illness and the impact on their daily life. So, for example, there's a big difference in having anxiety that makes it difficult to go into busy shopping centers, for example, and anxiety that's so severe that you can't go to a job. You can't work around other people. The inpatient services that we provide at Eastside are generally for folks who are experiencing that more significant distress in their daily life and dysfunction.
The definition, if you look in the book that we use to define what a psychiatric disorder is, you know, they almost always have significant functional impairment. And so that's important because you have to look at the baseline of the person, not just how they're doing, because a very high functioning person, somebody who is running a business, that sort of thing, they may have significant functional impairment, but still be able to work, still be able to hold down their job, but they're not functioning as well as they should be or would be otherwise. I think it's important to help people understand that there's a lot of things that we can do, even if you're still able to live fairly well, still able to do pretty well at your job and that sort of thing. And it doesn't always involve medications. And I think that's something else that people get hung up on, is they don't want to be labeled as something if they're taking a medication. And sometimes medication is not indicated.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people might think, okay, you got a mental illness, I'm going to go to Eastside Hospital, they're just going to give me some kind of a prescription and medicine, and that'll be it. But there's a lot more layers involved.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the challenges that we face in the hospital environment and treatment is that mental health treatment, counseling, psychiatry is portrayed maybe on television or you know, in the mainstream media, isn't always congruent with how we actually practice. And one of our biggest challenges on the front end when folks are starting a course of treatment and they're really not sure what to expect is to lay out those expectations for them. So that it isn't a scary situation or something that's intimidating, but rather it's getting treatment for a health condition that you have, just like any other condition that we treat at Eastside.
What about those folks that may still not seek the treatment they should be seeking because they're concerned about this quote-unquote stigma?
I think it's important for the family to be involved. A lot of reluctance to get treatment comes from family ideals. And so, for example, if you feel like, you know, your inability to be happy, to be in a good mood, makes you weak or makes you crazy, something like that, then you might be reluctant to admit that something is going on. So for the family, it's important just to accept the person where they are, offer to try to help them, to find resources, that sort of thing. The other thing is, you know, unfortunately, we do sometimes have patients that have to come to the hospital involuntarily, you know, because of some things that are going on, and if they present a safety risk to themselves or others. So it's one of the parts of my job that I don't enjoy, but I understand it's necessary, and we try to work with the patient as much as possible to help them understand that, not that there's something wrong with them, but that they're not doing as well as they could. And right. I can probably help them do better if we work together.
For that person that may be listening to this show and they think, okay, I may need a little help myself, and now that I've learned a little bit more from listening to both of you, or there's someone in my family that I believe may have a mental illness, what would your advice to them be? What is the first step? What should they do?
I think the first step is, if you know, if the person is not in immediate danger, if you're not really concerned that, you know, they might take their own life, they might hurt somebody else, that sort of thing, then the best place is to start with an outpatient psychiatrist. Okay. You want to try to establish care with somebody just like you have a primary care doctor. You need to have a primary psychiatrist, somebody who follows along with you on a long course, that knows you well and can kind of adjust things as time goes. Because even when people are stable, whether it be regarding hypertension or major depressive disorder, sometimes you need tweaks in your medications. And it's a lot better to have somebody that you know before you get in a crisis than to try to go to an ER and then establish care. Because even if you do end up in the hospital, which is, you know, obviously not optimal for a lot of people, if you end up in the hospital, I can treat you, I can take care of you. But then when you leave, I have to find somebody else to help you after that. And there are not enough psychiatrists in this country or in Gwinnett County specifically. And so it can be hard, and even when you find somebody, there's often a long wait. So that would be the first thing, is just to look for somebody that you like working with, that you trust, because if you don't trust your doctor, you're probably not going to be making the best decisions.
It's also important to just point out that when folks or their families are at that decision point, that we can help guide folks through that too. One of the things that we're really fortunate to have at Eastside, because we have two full service emergency departments, we staff those emergency departments with an intake and a psychiatric intake and assessment department as well. So at any given time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we have two master's prepared psychotherapists or psychiatric nurses on staff on site who are able to assess folks who come into either of our emergency departments and help the emergency department team and that patient to figure out where they are on that journey, and whether, you know, inpatient hospitalization isn't always the outcome of that visit. We make a ton of referrals to outpatient providers. We make a lot of referrals to support groups and the like. And even, you know, if you're not at the point of crisis, on our website, you can find the phone number for our assessment department and call them. And they take a lot of calls on any given day to help direct folks to those resources.
That's eastsidemedical.com. You can go on there and find out about all the services that they provide, including in the behavioral health services area. And that's just some of the segment from a special Eastside Medical Center edition of Gwinnett Business Radio. For the entire interview, go to businessradiox.com, select the Gwinnett Studio, and then click on Gwinnett Business Radio. Coming up next on the Best of Business Radio X,
Would you be willing to step into an aircraft that travels over 3,000 miles per hour and can get you to Europe in under 90 minutes? Hypersonic air travel and Mach 5 aircrafts may be here before you know it. The future of travel coming up next on North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X. Welcome back to North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X. Can you imagine getting from New York City to Paris, France in only an hour and a half? Well, an Atlanta-based company is developing an aircraft that will travel five times the speed of light, hypersonic speed. On Travel Safely with Brian Mulligan, host Brian Mulligan spoke with A.J. Piplica, the founder and CEO of Hermias, a company developing a Mach 5 aircraft with the goal of massively reducing flight times for long-haul business class air travel. The aircraft will be capable of traveling 4,600 miles at a speed of 3,300 miles per hour.
Well, it all starts with Star Trek and Star Wars back in the day.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up in Florida. I was born in New York, but grew up in Florida. Went to Georgia Tech for undergrad and did my master's there as well, both in aerospace engineering. When I went in, I didn't really know kind of what to expect in terms of where that would take my career and life in the future. I think I can kind of go back to the first air show I ever went to is at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. And there was a C-5 Galaxy, so it's one of the largest cargo aircraft that we have. And to see something, you know, the size of a building lay on its side and take off and go fly, that just boggled my mind. It's like something that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, it's impossible, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to go make things like that. So that's what kind of drove me to Georgia Tech in aerospace. And, you know, I learned through not just my academic work, but also through internships and co-op experiences at NASA, down at Johnson Space Center in Houston, what it meant to be an aerospace engineer. It's there's so much more to the game than, tube and wing aircraft. Everything from spacecraft and satellites to rockets and now hypersonic aircraft. So after university, I started working at a local aerospace company called Spaceworks, started doing conceptual design for all sorts of aerospace systems, but focused on reusable launch vehicles and high-speed aircraft. So I kind of learned my way through from the back of a napkin, put some numbers behind designing an aircraft that flies five times the speed of sound. From there, I kind of branched into the entrepreneurial part of my background. So within Spaceworks, we started a subsidiary company called Generation Orbit, and that company was started to build small rockets to launch small satellites to orbit. So these are satellites you can hold in your hand.
Oh, wow.
So we took that company. We had never built anything before, so the first thing we wanted to do was build a rocket and show that we can do it. And the mission for that rocket ended up being not going to orbit, but flying really fast in the atmosphere. So it was kind of like a flying wind tunnel, if you think
about
it.
Right.
So that kind of brought together aviation and space in a way that I hadn't really thought about, when I was in school. But that's really, I think, where the origin of Hermias comes from, is kind of the bringing together of this commercial space way of doing business that we've seen through, Blue Origin and SpaceX and companies like that, and applying it to, the aviation part of the industry that's, for the better part of the past 50, 60 years, we haven't gone much faster. And we've done a lot to kind of improve the efficiency and safety of air travel, but speed hasn't changed. It's actually gone backwards a little bit.
Correct.
And, we have a lot of aerospace in not just the city of Atlanta, but the state of Georgia. I mean, we have Delta headquartered here. We have UPS headquartered here, Gulfstream down in Savannah, Lockheed Martin. Aerospace is, I think, the third or fourth largest export of the state. And, most people don't necessarily realize
that.
That's
a good point.
Yeah.
Are you able to attract the right kind of talent here to Atlanta?
I mean, yeah, that's a great question. We get it all the time. Atlanta's a pretty unique place to be working on these types of things. You've already hit on a number of the pieces that make Atlanta kind of a transportation hub. We have the busiest airport in the world, Delta, UPS, Gulfstream.
Yeah.
The second best aerospace school in the country in Georgia Tech. But I think there's a lot of people who want to work on these types of problems, but don't necessarily want to live in the typical hotbeds of Los Angeles or Silicon Valley or even the Northeast. So, having a place in the Southeast that is unique And where, you know, we are unique, there's not a whole lot of companies like us here. That gives us a competitive advantage.
Given that typically the way venture funding works is that they look at an existing business and then you come up with a business plan that's just a little incremental step from where everybody is. Now, building an airplane that flies five times the speed of sound, that's not an incremental step from where we are. How do you set about attracting funding with what might be considered a long shot business?
Sure. I think you kind of have to look for the right people. There are plenty of visionaries out there who their mission as a venture capitalist is, you know, not necessarily, obviously it's, you know, to provide a return, otherwise they wouldn't be in business, but they have an opportunity to take bets on things that are kind of high risk, but very high payoff in terms of the effect that they can, you know, the positive effect they can have on society. So the pool of venture capitalists that are able to do that and interested in doing that is obviously smaller than the whole. But those are the kinds of people that, you know, we're interested in working in.
And sort of what sort of time frame are they looking at? You know, some kind of...
It depends.
A decade?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the pretty long-term side of venture, you know, 8 to 10 years. But, you know, given what we're doing, it's not going to be, you know, 10 years before the company has revenue. There's a pretty good incremental path along the way as we're kind of building... We're starting small, building small vehicles, and then kind of growing them in terms of scale and capability. And that'll allow us to access a couple of ancillary markets along the way and grow the company's revenues along with, you know, the funding that we're raising.
Tell us specifically about the business, Jess. How do you go from a Concorde, which you know, was a great technical success all those years ago and then ended up commercially struggling? How do you go from there to a business class supersonic jet? How fast will it fly? How high? What, and so forth?
So yeah, Concorde is a really interesting story. You know, it was developed by two governments. The company that we know today as Airbus came out of that development program. And that drove a lot of the way that kind of its cost structure was built up. So, but I mean, it operated successfully for, you know, 25 years or so and was one of the safest aircraft in the skies. There's a lot of technology that's kind of improved since, you know, the Concorde days. We kind of place our interest in three core areas. One is artificial intelligence, so driving the massive amounts of data that we'll be gathering and all of the testing on the ground in simulation and in flight that we'll be doing into, you know, fully autonomous systems down the road. Obviously, there are laws that we have to deal with, but that's kind of a core competency that we'll be building into the...
So the whole basis of this, that actually will be an autonomous hypersonic jet.
We'll see. So when we get to flying people, there'll be pilots on it to start.
There'll be pilots, but the idea is...
The framework will be there. The experience base will be there to make a transition down the road because, you know, when you're flying at Mach 5, the amount of time you have to make a decision is very, very small.
The pilots will be supervising systems. I mean, fly-by-wire is already well known in the aircraft industry, so it's not like it's going to be new. But in other words, the first line reaction to disturbances and things will be done by computers. Is that what we're saying? With the pilot supervising those systems?
Yep. And eventually we'll kind of progress into different levels of autonomy and decision making, but that's for the future.
How about engines and types of fuel and stuff? Are these scramjets or they...
Close. So on the propulsion side, we will be using a ramjet for the high speed portion of flight. So that's kind of like a scramjet, but the combustion stays subsonic. So when the air is going through the combustor, it stays below the speed of sound. So we slow it down pretty substantially. Problem with a ramjet is you can't generate thrust when you're not moving. You have to get up to supersonic speeds to start generating shockwaves, compressing the air and burning it. So we'll be using a turbojet for the low speed portion of flight. So pretty similar to the way that you know, commercial aircraft are powered today. And then some little magic sauce to bridge the gap between the two.
What about the noise? How did you deal with sonic booms and supersonic travel over land?
Yep. So given the way that the kind of current legislations are, which in the United States say that you cannot fly commercially faster than Mach 1 over land, regardless of whether or not you make a sonic boom on the ground, we've based the business case completely on over water routes. So this is crossing oceans. Now, if the laws change, which I think there's being quite a bit of progress going on right now in improving those laws, becoming kind of performance-based, we can't bank on that. So we banked our business case on the way the laws are written today, which means flying over water. So routes similar to what Concorde flew, although a bit broader. So, you know, crossing the Atlantic Ocean is, you know, probably the most popular route, but also crossing the Pacific. And then there's also a number of north-south routes that are pretty interesting, both in Asia, North and South America, Europe, Africa.
So you're talking about long distance hypersonic
Well, that's where it makes sense, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you're going to spend 10, 20 minutes accelerating up to Mach 5 and decelerating back down. So in order for it to make sense, you kind of have to apply it to long distances. Like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily fly from Atlanta to Savannah. You'd probably drive a car in that case because of all the time it takes to go to the airport and so forth. So, yeah, this is really for longer distance travel.
The $64,000 question is, where are you in development? Is this still at the back of a napkin stage, mm-hmm. or are you building hardware? Where are you in that paradigm?
I'd say definitely in between back of a napkin and flying things. So this year we're working, our main technical objective is to build the first prototype of our engine. So that'll function from wheels stop on the ground all the way up to Mach 5. And we'll be testing that in a wind tunnel on the ground. So,
Are there wind tunnels here in Atlanta that support Mach 5?
No, we'll be going up to Indiana.
Okay.
Actually, there's some university tunnels up in Indiana that have facilities that kind of meet our needs. That's the main goal for this year. And then over the kind of following 2.5 years or so, our goal will be to get that engine into an airframe and then up into the air. And then demonstrate that we can take off from the ground, touch Mach 5, come back and land, and do that over and over and over again with tons of instrumentation. There's so much we have to learn.
And is this going to be a carbon fiber airframe?
It'll be primarily metallic. So the kind of third leg of the stool, if you will, on the technology front for us, artificial intelligence and then propulsion. The final one is high-temperature structures. So the titanium alloys that we have today commercially available are pretty good up at the temperatures that we'll be seeing in most of the airframe for cruising at Mach 5. Certain parts of the airframe will be composite, potentially, so the leading edges of the wings and the nose where it gets really, really hot. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the structure will be titanium.
Do you think the future holds for supersonic flight and space travel in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, is this all going to be for real, do you think?
Absolutely.
How many companies are there working in a similar space to you?
So in let's call it, you know, supersonic aircraft. So besides us, you have Boom Supersonic. So they're building a Mach 2.2 commercial aircraft. It'll carry 45, 55 people or so. You have Aireon Supersonic. They're working on a 11 or 13 passenger business jet that'll fly Mach 1.4, 1.6. There's another company called Spike, also working on a Mach 1.6 or 1.8 business jet. And then you have the rocket folks. So Elon has talked a lot about using Big Falcon rocket for moving people from one place to another. I think it's an interesting way of doing things for really, really long range missions, like, you know, halfway across the world. I think for crossing oceans, I think airplanes are still going to be the more efficient choice. You know, we have the same things to prove, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, nobody has flown a Mach 5 aircraft reusably before. So we have to do the same thing and prove that it can be done reliably.
How many people are going to be on your plane?
Our cabin will carry about 20 people. So that's
a good size business jet.
Yep, good size business jet. And at Mach 5, it's actually a pretty viable commercial airliner as well.
All right, and that gets you across the Atlantic in
90 minutes.
90 minutes. Wheels up to wheels down.
Yep.
And that's just part of the interview from Travel Safely with Brian Mulligan on Business Radio X. To hear the entire conversation, visit businessradiox.com, click on the Gwinnett Studio, and then select Travel Safely. Coming up next, a local tax expert shares some common tax problems and how you can avoid a visit from the IRS. North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X continues after this. Welcome back to North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X. Tax season may be over, but for many, their tax problems may continue. What happens when you get a letter from the IRS stating that you owe taxes? And what are your options if you can't pay those taxes? On this week's edition of The Bottom Line, tax solution expert Jacqueline Sheldon shared some answers.
The IRS recently released a study saying that they had over 14 million cases currently in the collections division, so that's quite a few.
That's a lot.
And that one in every 60 taxpayers has a back tax liability. So chances are everybody knows someone. It's not something that people talk about a lot, but chances are everybody knows somebody that is dealing with a back tax issue with the IRS. cases I generally see are usually 1099 contractors or other self-employed individuals. Taxpayers who, for whatever reason, haven't filed returns in several years, they'll end up with a large balance that's accrued over the years and penalties and interest on top of that for not filing. So that's usually the cases that I see.
Snowball effect. It just gets bigger.
It is a snowball effect.
They fall behind.
I talked with someone a couple weeks ago, and they kind of had that same situation. They didn't file their 2014 return. They had somebody prepare it, and there was a balance due, and they didn't have the money to pay it, so they didn't file 14. And then 15 rolled around, and they're like, well, if we didn't have the money to pay 14, we're not going to have the money to pay 15, so they didn't file 15, and you can see where the story's going. So now we have 14 through 2018 that's got to be filed, and once everything is prepared and shakes out what their balance is, then we'll deal with what options that they might have for paying those back taxes.
But hopefully they will have some options.
Now, there are some options. We're going to talk a little bit about that here.
I imagine all this is pretty scary for the person holding that letter from the IRS.
Well, receiving an IRS notice can be pretty scary. I've had clients who have brought me in a bag full of IRS letters that they haven't opened. I've had clients that's walked in holding them by the corner of the envelope like it's a ticking time bomb that's
waiting
to explode.
Don't even look at it.
Exactly. So it can be a pretty scary thing. But the worst thing someone can do if they receive a notice from the IRS is to ignore it. It's not something out of sight, out of mind situation. You throw that letter in your bottom desk drawer, and then a few weeks later you'll get another letter, and then a few weeks later another, and eventually you'll have someone knocking at your door.
So when someone finds themselves in this situation, they're getting letters, what kind of options may they have?
Well, the first option that they can look at is setting up a payment plan, and that's what the IRS refers to as an installment agreement. And this will allow the taxpayer to pay their tax balance over a period of time. And the IRS does have a short-term payment plan, which will allow people to pay for a period of up to 120 days. And then they also have longer term options where you can actually make payments over 36 all the way up to 72 months on your tax balance. So that's always something to consider. Now, if the taxpayer owes less than $50,000, it's pretty simple to get a installment agreement set up. But if the balance with the taxes, penalty, and interest is more than $50,000, then it is a little harder. The IRS does require what's called a collections information statement. It's an IRS form that you're required to complete.
So it's a legal document,
basically. And send backup documentation to kind of prove what your income and expenses are. And that allows the IRS to be able to determine what they think your ability to repay your tax debt is. Another thing that taxpayers have to keep in mind if they're going into an installment agreement is they have to be in compliance.
There's that word again.
Right. We talk about compliance a lot.
All the time.
But basically that means that all their tax filings are up to date. So if their 2018 return is extended, they need to get that 2018 return filed. And then they need to make sure that they are dealing with this year's estimated tax payments, or if they're a W-2 employee, that they're having enough withheld out of their paycheck so that they're covering their tax obligations for 2019. The IRS is willing to work with you on back liability, but they want to make sure that you're not continuing to dig a hole each year by not paying it enough.
If you're not current, you can't fix something from the past.
Right. It's like trying to put a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. You know, you need to fix the problem.
There's got to be fees, there's got to be interest, there's got to be something associated with all these arrangements.
Well, there is. The IRS does charge a fee to set up an installment agreement. Depending on how you set it up, it can run anywhere from $31 for what they call a direct debit installment agreement, all the way up to $225. So there is a fee. You know, the tax balance is also still subject to penalties and interest. Those continue to accrue during the time you're making these payments. So you've got to keep that in mind as well. Normally, the late paying penalty is 0.5% each month. But if you set up an installment agreement, the IRS will cut that in half. So you're only paying 0.25% a month on the penalty. And then there's also interest, which, you know, the interest rates vary from quarter to quarter. Currently, you're looking at about 6% interest, though, on any balance that you still have with the IRS.
Yeah. What other options? Anything else?
Well, there are other options that are available. There is something called an offer in compromise, which will allow qualified taxpayers to settle their tax debt for less than the amount originally owed. Now, there are some pretty strict requirements that have to be met for a taxpayer to qualify. And the process is very tedious. Oftentimes, it'll take 9 months to a year or even longer to get an offer in compromise in place. It does require IRS financial information so that they can determine your ability to pay. And what the IRS looks at in this case is what income you have coming in, what expenses you have. They will allow you certain amounts for living expenses, but nothing over and above certain.
So the new Mercedes out front may not be an allowable living expense?
No, that's it. They look and give you some minimum expenses that they will allow you to take, but anything over and above that, they figure that money could go towards paying your taxes instead of paying for that new Mercedes.
I got you.
They also look at assets. What do you own that they could tap into, which may mean selling that Mercedes or possibly getting a loan on your home if you have equity in your house. And then they also look at the collection statute and how much time is left that they have to collect this tax debt. Because from the time the tax is assessed, the IRS actually has 10 years that they can collect that tax.
Wow.
So if they feel like you have the ability to pay it over however many years are left in that collection statute, then they're not going to accept an offer. They're going to wait you out and try to get that money over a period of time.
What's the biggest settlement you've ever seen for one of your clients?
Probably the biggest settlement we've had, we had a client that owed just over $100,000 in back taxes, and we were able to settle it out for $10,000, so about 10 cents on the dollar, so that wasn't a bad settlement.
That's like a magic act or something you did.
And that's tax solution expert Jacqueline Sheldon on The Bottom Line with Jacqueline Sheldon. To hear the entire episode, visit BusinessRadioX.com, select the Gwinnett Studio, and then click on The Bottom Line. Well, that's it for this week. Today's interviews are just a few of thousands that you can hear anytime, 24/7, by visiting the Voice of Business, BusinessRadioX.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Salmon, and this has been North Georgia Business Radio and the best of Business Radio X.